From multiple pragmatic locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steven McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Laura Underwater, concept artist for Green Sky Games, to discuss visual world building. So, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Laura, we finally got you in the clubhouse. I feel like this has been a long time coming.
Yes, it has. I've been bugging you for quite a while.
And you wore us down, and finally you broke down the plywood door to the clubhouse.
Yeah. Listen, I had to get the crowbar. I had to get the axe. It was just...
You had to get the crowbar so that you could get the axe, and then you had to go across the map.
Yeah, exactly. I also found a bunch of health kits outside of this place. So, is there a boss fight coming up or what?
Oh, we were saving those for later. Oh.
Is that an aspect of visual world building?
We'll get to that, Steven.
Okay, all right. We'll get to
That's foreshadowing.
Okay, yes. So listeners may be able to tell from our tone, but Laura's a friend of ours. Laura, we worked with you. Ellen and I worked with you on Sonder way back when, game jam game we did. It was deep in the pandemic era, which means it was 100 years ago. But for listeners who don't know who you are, give us a little background on your expertise and, you know, goings on.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I've been introduced, I'm Laura Underwater. I apparently make nice games. I have been a concept artist in the industry for about 7 years, on and off, doing freelance stuff. I have quite a history in fine art. I took it 2 degrees in college. I was in high school all for art. And now I'm working currently with the VR company Green Sky Games. We just launched our latest game as of recording yesterday. So it's been quite a whirlwind. But I've just... Basically, my entire game career, I've been doing a lot of drawing and doing a lot of planning for everybody else in the companies I'm in.
Mm-hmm. As a concept artist, I think for people who are developers who come into it from either 3D art or programming or just purely from design, you are most familiar to them as a fine artist is the output that you put out. And also, that means you're probably the most alien to a lot of developers, is my guess.
Sometimes it feels that way, yeah. Because they'll see like a concept artist and they'll think of, oh, well, you're the one who just makes either the pretty drawings or the one who gives the art to the 3D team and they make something that we can actually use out of it.
Yeah.
Which is yes and no in many regards.
Right,
At the very least, I do have some history in game design myself. So,
mm-hmm. So it's accurate, but also insulting a little bit. Right.
Sometimes it feels like, oh, you know, I do know how the sausage is made, unfortunately. Yeah. So
the reason I bring up this sore subject is because I'm very curious, because your background as an artist, and you went straight into games. And so I'm really curious about your motivation for not because it was like a particularly unusual thing, but you had so many options. Your talents could go to many different industries. There's no field that couldn't use someone with your talents. So why games?
On my end, honestly, it was, I always enjoyed games myself as just a recreational thing. So there was that aspect to it. Mm-hmm. But even as an artist, I loved world building. I loved being able to draw whatever I wanted to kind of create off of that. So, you know, this is just a character, but where do they exist? What happens to them? What parts do they interact with? What do they need? And then just going off of that and creating off of that. But it's also a third thing, which is in my fine art, I always loved interactive media, especially with, now that I can't remember the name of it, but basically installation art.
Yeah.
Where you yourself can walk into spaces. Meow Wolf was always a huge inspiration to me. Just because of all of the work that they do and kind of creating these worlds that you get lost in through this art. So kind of all three things together kind of pointed me towards that direction. And from a more pragmatic side, I just did not want to become an animator. So.
I mean, yeah, good. that's tough. Yeah. That's... okay, well, I think there's something in there that you hit that really brings us right into the topic, which is that the narrative element, right? That these aren't just images, they are part of the storytelling. And that's our topic, right? Is the visual world building. So, Stephen, you have a question to start off this topic that you've been very careful not to spoil for yourself up to now. So let her rip.
Yeah, we were talking before recording, and I was like, don't spoil this for me. I want to learn on show. What is visual world building? I have an idea on what it is, but I don't know for sure, and I would like that to be cleared up for me, if you could.
I can certainly try. Well, visual world building, I mean, I did say before, it is finding the health kits right before the big boss. It's finding the ammo. That's part of it.
Ah, I knew it.
But it's also everything that you interact with in the world of, like, everything that you see and everything that you interact with is part of visual world building. So you have the classic things like the Fallout skeletons, the Bioshock graffiti. That sort of thing is considered like environmental storytelling, but it's still visual world building in the sense that you get a knowledge of the characters or the world or even the gameplay. And we think of that mainly in games that are very storytelling heavy, but they're ways you can use a visual world building in everything, in visual storytelling in any kind of game.
Okay, that clears things up. So, like, it's not just specifically the writings on the wall. I put it as an example in the script here, Ratman from Portal, like the scribbles and like in between the little cracks and stuff of some of the puzzles. That's Ratman. I put that as an example, and I suppose it sounds like that kind of is an example, but that's like a very overt example. But like maybe the way that you actually get health in the game is an aspect of visual world building. Like instead of like if the health pack doesn't look like a health pack, but instead looks like a potion, like that could be visual world building. Yeah. Maybe. Okay.
I mean, there is one kind of example that I love, and it's in Dishonored. It's been a while since I played it, but I had to kind of go back for this podcast. The health potion you have is basically the Sokolov elixir, which is a cure for the plague in the game. Or at least it staves off the effects.
Yeah.
And how you play can determine, you know, if you play the game very high chaos, you need a lot of potions because you're going to be fighting, you're going to be getting hurt a lot. Right. So you're actually stealing this cure from people. And like you're actually looting it from dressers, from places all over the map. If you're low chaos, you don't need them often. So you don't need to actually be like stealing any of these cures, these health items for anybody else.
Yeah.
And so that is a kind of world building where your actions with this small, you can almost consider it inconsequential, but it is a huge part of the storytelling. And if you play more chaotically, later in the story, you actually get more enemies that are like plague ridden and will be a huge problem later on. And it's almost insinuated because you stole like the cure to this plague.
Yeah.
They kind of started coming into the world.
Mm.
So it is absolutely, you know, finding the health potion, but it's also your interactions with these worlds and how it's been kind of designed by everybody in the team. But yeah, absolutely, the writing on the wall and the Ratman. It is a bit of like a being hit over the head with a pan, sort of like here's the world building. But
yeah,
it's a very good thing to have sometimes, because sometimes you need to have like the actual storytelling be that overt.
Yeah, yeah. I remember like, you know, 2016, 15, stuff like that. Everybody was like, oh, look at all this writing on the wall. This is so like, it's too on the nose. Why do we have all this stuff? And then like the pandemic happened and there was just a bunch of writing on the wall and everybody's like, oh, sorry y'all, actually this is what happens in real life. Apologies to all you background artists. It was pretty funny.
Well, I think that's the distinction, and you were thinking, yeah, the environmental storytelling, it's kind of why it has its own name, because that's a specific technique and a practice, and sometimes just like that's a piece of environmental storytelling. And my conception of it is that a visual world building is broader, more all-encompassing, is more of a concept rather than an actual thing you're doing. And Laura, you put it really well. It's like it's how all those things come together, and the visual component is the avenue with which you enter that holistic process. And so it's kind of hard to say that it's any one thing, I think.
Yeah, it is really hard to get like a full definition of it too. Mm-hmm. It's how you and the player kind of interact with the game, because the player's going to come up with their own story no matter what you do anyways.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's interesting. Over the hiatus, we replayed an episode where we talked with a guest about when to use less words. When you tell the narrative team, like, we can say this with less, and how do you say it, right? And that's where you need to draw on the disciplines of other people. And the skills of other disciplines rather, to do that. And so once you start citing examples, it's hard to pull it all apart, right? Because it's all the different systems of a game and different skills it took to make it go into that final interaction and experience for the player. But I think, that component of like, okay, well, you need to label everything, you know, so it works in the inventory. But like, that actually isn't the way we want to explain what the thing is to the player, right? And we want to like show that it's red or blue, and that's great, but there's actually maybe other more sophisticated ways it can relate to other things, you know? So it's a big, big idea. But tricky, I imagine.
Yeah.
So where do you start?
You start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. But no, honestly, visual world building and visual storytelling, in terms of games, like games in any way that you want to use it in, has to kind of come in pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it really focuses on what are the environments going to look like? What little things can we add to make it less of a talking to about the... also, I apologize if you can hear that. But what kind of mechanics do we have that are going to give less words but still get the same idea across? On my side, you have to kind of start with the game designers, talking to them, like, what are you trying to get across? Then the writing team of, like, all right, what's the story? What is the most important? And then even, like, the level designers being, like, where are we looking in this one particular moment? And in this entire process, how do I like shoehorn in this idea in the most calm way possible? If you do it later on in the process, if you're doing it, you know, 3/4 of the way through development, you're kind of fighting against everything else, because you need to think of like, okay, so this is the model already. Well, now we need to figure out, does this actually fit the world narrative? Does this give across any information, or is this just a health pack? Do we need to figure out why there's a health pack here? Like, is this something like Half-Life 2, where there's going to be stations all over the place because it's OSHA compliant? Or is it just here because we need a health pickup?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I think you're explaining to us the difference between storytelling and world building, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because storytelling, you're going to have the narrative of like beginning, middle, end, and whatever else you need, but the world that we're inhabiting in games is so much more than just the character and the enemies or your objective.
Yeah.
It is everything around you. And, you know, some games you don't need too much world building. You're going to just be a pixel. But even the color, the sound, any lighting you have is going to affect what your storytelling is.
Yeah.
Thomas was alone would not be the same if it was in a white blank space for the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because you have that dark background, you feel very desolate and isolated in the beginning, and as more colors come in, you start to feel a little bit more, you know, you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that informs other choices. So like a way a level is laid out, if it's tight and compact, or if it's wide open, and that game has both of those things, that feels different in a dark environment than it does in a bright environment. The implications are different. And so all those things are connected. I think a lot about films where I'll watch a movie and there'll be this really cool shot. And it's like, that. Oh, that's so cool. And it has nothing to do with anything else. And I think it's really easy to do that in games as well, because there's so many opportunities and because we're always tweaking and changing and there's so many happy accidents that it's really easy to like run with something that's really cool, but forgetting that like you haven't set up the world to support that cool idea.
I'm glad you brought up other media too, because I was thinking about like with like books, for instance. You have to do all of the visual world building, the world building, like in the text.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you don't really know what world you're in, and it could be anything. Some of that stuff can be subtle, but a lot of it you still have to like put into the text.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like with video games, and movies to some extent, frankly, the viewer, the player, can explore the world building, the visual stuff, kind of on their own without necessarily needing, without being guided towards a lot of like what's going on. Some of that stuff you will literally say in the script, right? Like, this takes place in Asia or something, right? But like, other things, like you could tell from like Mark was saying, like how a thing is shot, or like things in the background, or the kinds of clothes that people are wearing. All of those things are related to, those can both be related to video games and movies. But I also think that like video games are unique in that like the player kind of has more opportunity to explore a world and understand what a world is like through just the way that they interact with it. Whereas movies, it's more about like the details that you're paying attention to or seeing or not seeing.
It's just kind of the layers of perception that you're able to stack onto the medium, right? So like in a book, you're reading a novel and you're reading about some fictional world that, you know, the 18th million fictional world that Brandon Sanderson has invented. And you're like, you're imagining what it's going to be like, and you're imagining the textures, but it all has to be like rendered by your mental processes. Whereas if, you know, your explicit mental processes, or as I've been learning from educating intuition system too. But when you're doing something like you're watching a movie, then you're observing more of it. And so you're taking more of that in like intuitively through more of your perception rather than your cognition. And then I think you layer that on in video games, you're doing even more. You've got all the visual and the auditory, assuming you have all those senses available to you. You're taking all that information in, but then you're also playing with the physics of the game, and that tells you something about the world. And you're able to play around with like what you're actually looking at and what you're hearing. And it sounds like really the detailed work of planning that kind of those kinds of perceptual experiences starts with concepting out the world. Cool.
No, it really does, because you have to kind of plant a seed of like, this is what it could be. Can we make it all happen?
Yeah. And I think if we're taking these examples of books and film and what makes games different, like Ellen, I think you lined it up. It's this this escalating choices that are made by the artist or team of artists. And so the work, the cognition work that the player has to do is moved somewhere else. And so the question I have for you, Laura, is when do you leave things unsaid for the player to interpret versus make explicit in the visuals? Because you have that ability, but at the same time, you want ambiguity either as an element of the story or an element of the style. Where do you, I mean, this is a very generic question because it's going to be different for project, I imagine, but how do you make those determinations?
I mean, it is very much a project-to-project thing. Sometimes it happens by lucky accident. You know, you just don't have the time, or you don't have the resources to focus on something, or there's something that is so specific that you need to make sure that that is the most over the top. You cannot miss that. This is what it means.
Yeah.
And then the rest kind of becomes extra. But it's a hard question. It's a hard question to answer because it is so specific to projects. But it is a little bit of having to step away and look at everything as a whole and think, where does the silence need to last?
Mm.
It's almost like the same thing in films. Like, if you have a full movie of nonstop sound, you will not notice when it is loud because you have nothing to be quiet. So, well, the best thing I can think of right now is sort of Journey, where you go through it and the storytelling elements are very much when you're, you know, talking in the cutscenes to the really tall figure, and that gives you the visual storytelling in a very specific way. You can kind of infer the story. But as you're going through the levels, you can kind of see small things here and there and the scripted moments. And those are like the quieter side, but even in the quietest side is you can just walk into the sand and see different things. You can try and find small little moments. And each of those echo very differently in terms of visual world building, because you have the loudest, the medium, and the quiet.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only really tell that by sort of having everybody in the team basically take a look back up and say, like, where do we need a break?
Mm.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And that really depends on hopefully having the time and effort and the energy to do that. Because, like I said, sometimes it's the complete opposite way of, like, we need to make sure this gets said and everything else is just fine.
Yeah, yeah. There's two questions, follow-up questions I have for you based on that answer. The first one is that categorization of, like, the sort of scale of the impact on the player that you're describing. That implies, essentially, a disconnect between the player experience and the artist's input, right? So you put a lot of effort into things they're not really going to notice, and that's a success. And then you'll put plenty of effort, as always, into the big things that they're going to notice. But maybe that's a little bit of an easier job, perhaps. Do you have to keep an eye on that? Like, is it easy to conflate those things, or is it a very natural, as you do it, you kind of experience it sort of similar to the player, and it's actually not that big of a dilemma?
Usually it can come on very naturally because, you know, if you're playing your game, if you're going through, you're always play testing, you're kind of noticing the moments of what is going to be the moment of impact that you hope that your player is going to have.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But the only problem is that every player is a completely different person from the last one.
Yeah.
So the player is such an unknown element. You kind of have to hope for the best of, like, I'm putting myself in this player's shoes, and naturally I'm going to see in my own progression what is happening.
Yeah.
But, it almost is something that happens with practice. As you develop games, as you go in, and, you know, your first game is always going to be a little bit clunky in terms of world building, because the first time you're always going to say, I need to have everything, because the player can't miss anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, the more games you make, the more you learn to enjoy the silence.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that uncertainty, like, you design for it as well as, it's not just like, oh, well, they might not get everything. It's like, you have to design for them not to get everything. Like, you have to expect that and account for it, even though you don't know exactly how much is going to be taken in or not. Yeah, yeah.
And you have to be okay with somebody being wrong with your intentions.
Yeah.
You design something and all of a sudden the internet goes off. It's like, I believe it was pink because it had to be, you know, based on this character. And it's like, not even close.
Tried, but.
Yeah. That's cute and everything, but.
Yeah.
At that point, it's like, okay, it's already in the internet. Everyone's like, this has like 5,000 upvotes, whatever. I got to be okay with it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's interesting, because there's like a minimalism versus maximalism sort of thing with it, and I think that, like, oftentimes, you know, with games, you got a certain budget. You can only put so many things in the game, but, like, and so I think a lot of times people want to make sure to put in what is vital to the game, because, I mean, that's the stuff that people are going to see, theoretically. I mean, most of the time, people don't even finish half the games they buy, but that's a separate topic. But, like, I think that, like, there's something to be said for, like, putting in a bunch of attention to all these little small bits, because the people who do see those small bits, they really get a lot out of it. And you can see that, like, when people are playing different games. Like, I watch certain streamers when the like get to a point where I haven't, where I've gotten to in a game and I maybe didn't appreciate certain details about such and such things. But they go in and they see those details and they really appreciate them. And it makes me start to appreciate the game more because I see those in, sort of through fresh eyes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that like it's, I guess it makes it difficult to like what to actually prioritize. But I suppose if it all, if everything serves the purpose of telling, expressing something, expressing what you want from this game, then it's all worthwhile to put into the game, even if it feels like you're putting in a bunch of effort of for something really tiny that a lot of people won't see. I think the people who do see it, it will mean a lot to them.
Well, I think there's always the oh, like you said, Stephen, people who get it, who notice it, will get it. And then you kind of, as I've done this as an artist, you kind of lie to yourself and say like, and even the people who don't see it, it's kind of still there and it still impacts them.
Yeah.
But like, I think, Laura, you're right. Like some people just don't see it or they get it wrong and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think, we don't have to, if you can justify the work, even though you may know that it's really just to make it more real and inform other decisions you make, the actual particular piece of work, each individual atom of work isn't always going to be fully appreciated, but that's not the reason you do it. Right.
Right.
You're right. You kind of have to trick yourself into believing like all of this is necessary and I am doing this for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as everything important gets done and you get the Jira tasks done, then you can it's all right.
Okay. Before we move on, the second thing the follow-up I was thinking from what your earlier answer was about iteration, because you're talking about how the player experiences things and if that works or not and keeping an eye on that stuff. So as a concept artist who's sort of like at the beginning stages of a lot of this, where a lot of the ideas as you put them together, and you can correct me on this, but they start out very untested, right? And then you start, and then you have to test them either through just through the process of production or eventually through playtesting or any number of ways in which you can validate a design or both visually and game design as you go. So what is the role of iteration when it comes to, especially because we're very data-driven industry and very user centric, and sometimes we can lose the art in that. When you're thinking about big holistic world building, if someone doesn't get the structure of like that visual clue about what that potion looks like, and you need to change it for a UX reason, but suddenly that's sand in the gears of the whole system now.
Mm.
How do you deal with that? And what's the process?
Well, the first thing you do is go cry in the pillow for a bit because you worked hard on it. And
got it.
Mourn a little bit of the work you did.
Yeah.
But the next, honestly, what you have to do is, of course, you know, gameplay, all of that comes first because it's a game. It is not a movie. So you need to absolutely kind of figure out, okay, we need to change this and it's no longer going to be a potion. And it's going to be something completely different. At that point, you really need to start talking to the game designers, like, okay, where is it going to be seen? And then the narrative, like, okay, we need to all come together and figure out this is why it was designed this way. It can no longer work because of the UI or the UX. We need to fix this, or you need to give me any kind of information so I can come up with an answer that fixes everything. Because a lot of people think that concept art is just making pretty art. When in actuality, we're the ones hoping to give answers to questions that nobody asked.
Right,
because it's
right.
going to be necessary.
It's the first validation that you make for an idea. Yeah.
Because, you know, someone's asking, okay, well, we have to have a level that's really dark and we need to have a level that's claustrophobic. I have to come up with an answer of like, okay, it could be these three things. It could be like a sewer. It could be an office building. It could be this. Here's the reasoning of why it could be these things. And from there, it's the designer's job to pick which ones they like, or, you know, the art leads to be like, this is the one that works the best. And then we go forward with that. And of course, I mean, like you said, iteration is going to happen constantly. You know, the designs you made 3 months ago don't work now because this mechanic is no longer in the game. All right, now we got to come up with a new question, like a new answer to this question. And it's just a bunch of throwing things at the wall sometimes All right, narratively, this is now a injection because that works with the UI. We can still have the same sort of background to it and the same meaning behind it. but it is not something that interrupts with the UX. Or it could be something, you know, I'm really spitballing here, but it's the idea of having to, you go ground up pretty much every time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, those are all my follow-ups. I'm ready for the next section.
Cool. Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's kind of funny that you say that, because in the game I was working on recently, I mean, under the hood a little bit, I was kind of pulled in to do a lot of redesigning of the levels to give it more story.
Yeah.
And every time, I mean, of course, there was a lot of things like adding in billboards, adding in different designs, but it was mainly a lot of ground up. What is this location? Why is it here? And what can we change about it to make it seem like this? So, you know, a bunch of spaceships became things like metro stations in space, where like there's buses. There was one that became a mall. There was one that became a living community. And all of that because we need to give some kind of context and some kind of storytelling to explain why there were all these spaceships on Earth, like around Earth.
Yeah, and that speaks to the sort of two-way direction of these things. Sometimes it's this is the story I want to tell, and then let's build some mechanics to support it. And then here is a level we made. Now let's make sure that let's justify it with story that fits with everything else. There's no wrong way to start, right? There's no less valid approach, as long as what you end up with is the story you want, right?
I will say it's easier when you start from the beginning, but yeah,
sure,
absolutely. When you come in and you know you've got the levels, it's like, okay, you know what, we can do this, we can figure out what we're doing here.
That helps me I guess kind of formulate this next question. I'm curious, like, if there are certain narratives where visual world building is like, I mean, the impression I'm getting is almost all narratives, it's vital for you to have some form of visual world building component, because you can't just tell everything to the player that this exists in the world, because that's boring and no one likes exposition. At least not that way.
Sounds like a game design challenge.
If you want to, yeah, like we could just do a big, we could just try and do a novel. That'd be easier.
Yeah, right. That's a fair point. We're not making a novel, or we could make a novel. I guess it's just a visual novel. But anyways, my question is I was curious if there are types of games that visual world building does not serve as well. So an example I'm thinking of, if I'm correct about the name of the game, is Missile Command. A lot of the narrative of that game is told exclusively through gameplay. It's kind of like a real tragic, it's a really old game, but I mean, like, it's a tragic narrative if you like start thinking about like what you're doing, what the enemy's doing, and how like all of the pieces work together. But I don't think it has, aside from like, well, no, I guess it does. It feels like to me it doesn't have a lot of the kind of visual world building that we're talking about here.
Steven, I feel like if the rest of us just let you keep talking, I think you'll slowly change your mind.
Yeah, I was thinking about it now, and I'm like, wait a minute, because like the bunkers and the missiles.
Yeah.
Think about design is an aspect of it too.
Think about the composition of a screen of Missile Command, right? It's very all the ground is at the bottom, big open sky, right? So it's the sort of like impersonalness of war. Like, there's lots being told there. I mean, how much of that is deliberate, and how much of that is, well, we have a vector drawer and this is all we can manage and this is mechanically vital. But it does hang together. And if you were to remake that game today, those are the things you'd probably draw on, right?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Interesting. What's really interesting that you said that, Stephen, is like when you're, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying, Laura, about like you really need to start at the beginning, right? Because you're using the environment to reinforce the feelings that you want to have during gameplay. That none of those things have anything to do with the constraints of the technology or your art palette, like your color palette, right? Like you're thinking about the feelings that you want, and you're thinking about what kind of visual environment you want to create to reinforce those feelings and to support them. And then you all have to do that in your various disciplines within the constraints of your technology and your timeline and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's interesting. Given all that, I still wonder if there are types of games that like
I guess,
are there types of games that don't require it, or is it just we're not thinking about it broadly enough?
I'm wondering the extent of this limits, because I suppose this is more of a visual world building is more of a concept than it is a thing, right? Like, it's not a discipline in such and such. In such and such. I don't know if that's a sentence. Anyway.
No, that's right. Such and such.
Okay, cool.
Such and such. It's right here in Webster's.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks. But I guess I'm trying to understand the extent, the limit of this concept. Because I'm wondering, like, well, I know it's very useful. I guess I really just want to know the limit, I guess, of this concept. Laura, give me the limit.
I'll certainly try. I mean, you kind of hit on the head. Like, arcade games or like arcade style games are probably the one where it's the hardest to kind of think about it. Missile Command, I don't think, is the best example because, you know, it does touch on a very strong subject of war. And even the console itself, what you're playing on, at the time, people thought that that was actually what it looked like when people were, you know, if that was in a nuclear disaster, this is what's going to be the screen of someone who's shooting down the missiles. Mm. So, you know, that one's pretty much, you know, stronger subject. Or something like Tetris, where it's just a screen and blocks. You don't really have a lot to go on, especially because it's so simple. It's not to say you can't. There are, you know, rhythm games and things like that, and, you know, simple arcade games that have put a ton of visual world building and visual storytelling into it just by the UI and music and, you know, the effects that they use.
Yeah.
But it is something that is consciously done and something that is, like, made to be a point of we want to make sure the player has a feeling of ennui or they feel really excited, in so we make sure that this goes like this. And because of that, you know, it really is like those, like, small puzzle games, I think, is probably the hardest. Not impossible, but the harder ones.
I mean, Tetris, the reason why I steered away from Tetris specifically and other games like that is because, like, Tetris doesn't really have a story. There have been plenty of games where they try to put a story on the Tetris thing, but, like, there's a background behind Tetris that kind of gives you a sort of feel.
I can give you a little bit of background on that. So I think what you're hitting on is something that the board game industry deals with a lot, which is that you have a game and then you slap a coat of paint on it and call it the theme, right? That's a criticism, and I've probably leveled it on the show from time to time, that I have of board games generally, is that they tend to treat them as two separate things. And Tetris is a pretty close analog in the world of video games, because there are many versions of Tetris. So this is really easy to actually look, see for yourself. Like, the style of it, like the NES version of Tetris that I think a lot of people are maybe most familiar with, has a kind of industrial kind of look to it that is, I would say, I wouldn't say is unmotivated, but, like, there's not a lot sort of behind it that at least has then been further expressed by the developers of that version.
Yeah.
But as the story of Tetris is interesting, and there was a whole, like, kind of bad biopic about that one last year. But it was developed by a Soviet engineer at a state-run lab, and there's a whole drama about how that came over. And some of the people who made PC ports leveraged that context to make it a Russian-themed puzzle game. And they sold it to the West as this, like, you know, what people in the 80s feared of Russia is that they're all being trained by the state to be these, like, perfect, you know, it's like it's Rocky IV, right? And that was leveraged, and it was leveraged visually in the sense of this, like, the backdrops that were used and the kind of the coldness of Tetris, the pure logic behind it, that was, it's still a coat of paint on top of a puzzle game, but it kind of speaks to how the attempts vary in their effectiveness and their motivation, right? But, like, could tic-tac-toe, you could put a theme on it, but, like, the way you would think of tic-tac-toe normally is maybe that's past the limit, but someone could make an argument, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The choice of the X and the O, right? Instead of an open and closed circle. Like, maybe it doesn't mean anything to you, but someone could put context on that, you know?
That's true. That's fair.
I feel like that's a hell of an artist statement to write, though.
know that now I'm going to start making this argument, but when I was a kid, everyone wanted to be X. No one wanted to be O.
X is cooler.
X is, there you go. You know, like, I mean, it doesn't mean a lot, but it means something, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the thing we say a lot on the show is, like, you know, your ideas don't have to be grand, you know, just have some ideas, right? So, yeah. But I mean,
X is more fun to draw than an L. I'm gonna be stuck on this for a while now.
This is gonna be your stake to claim. Got it.
Maybe it's just because a circle's harder for like a 5-year-old to draw.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It goes deep.
Yeah, yeah. It goes deep. The insecurities at the heart of it. Yeah.
Okay, so what I'm understanding is there isn't a limit, really.
Yeah.
Anything can be anything, and that's how the world works. Got it.
That's the theme of the show, Steven.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we got like two themes. Anything is everything is everything, and making games are hard. Those are our two main points.
Uh-huh. Also, sometimes we team up to let the guest off the hook on a tough question. So
yeah,
thank you.
That's fair. That was a hard question. I'm trying to come up with an angle. Oh, yes, Ella.
Steven.
Yes.
When's the last time you wore the t-shirt for the show?
Actually, that's a very good question. It's been a little bit. I should break it out. I should be wearing that way more often because it's so comfy.
Yeah. I think I wore it. For me, my answer to that question is, I think last week.
Ooh.
I wore it during the day and then I wore it at night. I just kept wearing it. It just became pajamas, which was great.
That's one of the features of the shirt, is that you can wear, keep wearing.
Yeah.
It doesn't expire after 6 hours.
Absolutely.
Then I can wash it and wear it again the same way. But that is generally, when I wear the shirt, it is so comfy that it tends to turn into pajamas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but it does just fine during the day too. It's one of those things, you could dress it up, you could dress it down.
Yeah.
Wear it with jeans, wear it with your footies, whatever you wear for pajamas.
It's got a classy icon, so like, you know, it does kind of just work with everything. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
Good t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to wear it.
So for the purposes of this little skit, let's say I don't have one.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced by, you know, all of these stellar use cases.
Of course.
Yes.
And fantastic features. Where might I go to have what the two of you?
It's like, it's such an easy URL to remember. It's nicegames.club/shirt.
Yes. Okay, so I was gonna write that down but then you just jumped on it so quick I couldn't get my notebook out. But
you know, nicegames.club. Right. Exactly.
nicegames.club/shirt. Something like
shirt.
That, right?
Don't put shirt. Don't type
don't
shirt.
Put that down. nicegames.club/shirt.
Okay, I wrote it down that time.
That's probably good.
Yeah.
That didn't go how I thought it would.
It's fine.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Laura, I'm wondering if you, like, have you ever looked at a game and said, oh, there wasn't great world building on this team, or like something went wrong at that stage? And if so, what were the clues that led you to believe that? I know, we let you off of one tough question just to hook you with another one, right?
I know, yeah. It's one of those, I'm trying to think, because a lot of games that have bad world building, I don't stay it often. So it's the gameplay's decent, but I can't get over the fact that this is happening. So I think one of the big kind of proponents and one of the clues I always see is it's a design that, like, you know, things were designed or put around a level, or, you know, the lighting was this way because it looked cool, shut up.
Yeah, okay.
You know, this character has these really, you know, these huge pauldrons and this sort of design. It's like, okay, but it's clipping into the model. It's kind of doing these weird moments. What's going on here? You know, it doesn't really add anything visually or world building wise or even gameplay wise. And usually it goes back to either a producer or somebody saying, you know, I really like it. It's cool. We're putting it in here. And sometimes it works and, you know, you can kind of move around it. Other times it sticks out like a sore thumb. There is also sort of a pitfall that a lot of games go to, which is the yellow paint, which, you know, the painted ledges, sometimes, you know, you need to have it because you need to communicate to a player that, you know, you can actually interact with this. But when it is the only thing that you can see and the only thing you interact with, you know, it really does look like someone just kind of went around trying to make everything OSHA compliant and gave up.
Yeah.
That one's an interesting one because I think gamers complain about that too much and developers don't complain about it enough, I think. Because there's so many games that are like, this takes place in a real world, right? There might be fantasy elements, but it's all real. But then as they develop it, they're like, well, we need to have affordances for mechanics and we're not going to just have like them free climb this cliff. We're going to have snap points and blah, blah. And then suddenly it's like, well, this is no longer a real world anymore, but we're still going to maintain that. And that's allowed, right? Like, that's not a failure necessarily, but I don't think we recognize enough that's what we're doing. So when a gamer complains about it, the argument we should make is, yes, it's unrealistic. Yes, it's there solely for your mechanical affordance. That's why we did it. You know what I mean? Like, rather than to try to say, like, don't stop complaining, or, you know, it makes the game less realistic, but that's a choice we made, you know, deliberately and proudly, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting. It's like, it's almost the opposite of visual world building. It's like a window into the creation process of the game. Mm-hmm. When you see yellow paint, so you can jump on this cliff or whatever, that, like, a lot of players now see that as, the developers made sure that I know that I need to get to this thing. It's not necessarily an aspect of visual world building. If you could fit that into your world, that's great. Like, I think Mirror's Edge,
that runner's vision thing.
Yeah. Mirror's Edge has that runner's vision thing, which is kind of a cop out because it's like, it's still the same thing. But, like,
it justifies it within its own world, right? Which is not all games need to do that, but it's great. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, like, it is just how much you're willing to disillusion yourself from reality. Like, even the latest God of War, they had, you know, the painted walls too, but at least it was on theme, where it looked like runes or it looked like something specific to that world.
Yeah.
And it also was like the painted walls weren't just there. There were different colors and different uses of it other places in the game. So you were able to illusion yourself that, oh, you know, this is a gameplay mechanic, but it is not so far out of left field that I don't, you know, it sticks out so much.
Right. Yeah. And if you were to really sit down and think, like, who is it that painted all those runes? It would slowly start to fall apart. But, like, but you don't sit down and do that, right?
No.
You know, but, you know, it's not, I think it's people complain about it because it's a newer thing in games. I mean, newer, it's 15 years old or whatever, but the thing that always gets me in games that are really realistic is when they've gotten better at this, or they've more things, but still not really there. It's when a character picks up something in a third-person game, they just, like, there's the animation, they'll swing their hand across something, and then it will disappear. Yeah. And it's like, that is just accepted as totally fine, and yet people complain about yellow paint on a wall. Like, that's what takes them out of it. And it's like, you pick your level.
It kind of becomes pedantic.
Yeah. But, like, that shows that when you're making these choices to, like, build your world out of the visuals, to rephrase the topic of the episode, when you make those choices, like, there isn't a way to, like, fit all the puzzle pieces together, right? Like, it's all the other considerations, but at the same time, you can't make... There are no right choices. There are best choices, perhaps, but there isn't, you know, you're not going to be able to solve all those problems. And you're going to, like, sit thinking, like, racking your brain, like, still a problem. You're like, well, okay, can we adapt to it? Can we move around it? Can we ignore it? What can we do? But I think you'll drive yourself crazy trying to say, like, how can we make it so it's not a problem anymore? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm starting to hear that, like, part of the job of visual world building is also just being able to shove some stuff under a rug and make it as inconspicuous as possible.
Yes.
Okay.
If it seems like I've done no work, I've done my job well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. Like, if I can be the silent, like, yes, you came up with this idea all yourself, then I am happy.
Cool.
Because you don't. Yeah. Sometimes you need to shove the idea at the player, but other times you just want to give them the building blocks to make their own idea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a great phrase. I love that. You know, like, you don't have to give them the instructions to the Lego, like, thing that they have to build. You just have to make sure that you are leaving all the pieces in it, conspicuous places in it, and that they are likely to encounter them in a specific order so that they can figure out how they go together.
Yeah. And if they make a tree instead of Yoda, then it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as it's a cool tree.
Yeah. I mean, to be all new agey about it, it's really the player who's ultimately building the world. You're just leaving out, you know, the tools and the parts.
The cognitive building blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting because I guess now just backing up a second and thinking of like your greater degree of specialization in concept artwork, you're also setting up building blocks for the rest of the team to work with so that they can create more building blocks for the players to work with. Do you ever get frustrated at your distance from the player when you're in the concept art role? You're doing that work?
Sometimes. Mainly because it's a lot of, I do suggestions, I kind of give the basic idea, I give, you know, what the character's going to look like, or what the weapon's going to look like, and from there, I am trusting my 3D team, my level designers, that they will understand what I'm going towards and build off of it themselves,
mm-hmm.
and from there, I can feel the connection that way into, you know, what the player's going to experience, and how that works. And sometimes it'll change, and it'll be changed for the better. And sometimes it'll change, and I'll have to come in and say, this is why this was red. We cannot change it. Or, like, this is why I had this rock placed a certain way, because I needed it to show this. Mm. And sometimes I'm successful in getting that change back and explaining my reasoning for it, and sometimes it's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. And we adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's... There is a little bit of a disconnect, to answer your question, but in at least from what I've kind of experienced, it's easier to connect than most people would think, because it still is, you know, my work at the end of the day has influenced this entire game in some way, shape, or form, and so I can still kind of see these, like, you know, someone's going to come into Swarm 2, the game I just finished, and see all of the, like, all the billboards that I helped create, all the levels I helped design. And it's still going to be something that they interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Right. Like, your drawing of the scene that's at the very start of the process is not in the game any more than a building is made from blue paper. Right. But the discipline, the skill set that you have is generally considered the final product in other fields. And so that may be the source of the disconnect if you're not someone who does it, but just hearing the way you describe it, like, oh, that sounds like a lot of other creative roles, you know, that are foundational. But it does. I guess that leap of logic is, it takes a little bit of effort.
Yeah.
Everything just kind of builds off and it's all collaborative in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's what, I don't know, that's what I like about game development. Like, if I want to just live in my own head, I'll just, like, shut the door and turn off the computer and sit here, you know? And I don't want to do that. Like, there needs to be a back and forth. Like, and that's what's super fun about working with other people to create a project is, like, you are contributing something and maybe you aren't placing the exact pixels or you're not exactly, like, putting the model on the rig and making it walk around during a cutscene, but, like, you provided the visual language to allow that particular scene to be told in that way, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, God willing, you, like, everybody kind of comes together, puts their best work together that you couldn't have done alone, you know?
Yeah.
I get feedback from all over the company, and all of a sudden, you know, my work, which is good, it's now way better because it's everybody's trying to make the best product. And this is so true in everybody's game design. Like, nobody really wants to put out a game they're not happy with.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And no one wants to do work that is they're not proud of.
Yeah.
Or if they do, then I don't know them.
Yeah. I mean, on the flip side of that disconnect is you are also, in a lot of ways, freed from the burdens of implementation. And that is, you know, both good and bad, right? Contextually, sometimes you want that burden. Other times you can be more creatively free without it. But that leaves the question of, like, that process of communicating with the team, right? That process that Ellen was describing. Let's get technical. What are the tools you use? Like, what kind of, like, note taking or issue tracking do you use to make sure that your vision translates to a team of implementers who are also themselves visual artists? And what how much do you leave open for interpretation at that level? Because you know that they know best to make those particular choices.
That is it's a good question, and it is so many soft skills specifically. Yeah. Like, it is number one, knowing who you're working with. Who is on your art team, who, like, you can talk with somebody and realize, oh, they're really good at kind of bridging the gap between, you know, my drawings and getting a natural, like, rock formation out of it. And it kind of has to come from getting to know the team and really talking with them a lot, specifically even on the ideation process or when you're talking about your concepts. It's a moment of, all right, so this is the design. Is there anything you're confused about? Anything that you want me to go in more detail in? What do you need more of? What can I give as a option for you? And hopefully they'll communicate back saying, oh, I just don't know what this trapeze thing is. It's like, okay, I can make a front, back, and side for it so that is very clear. And then we can kind of go off of that. And it is a lot of trial and error, because in the first, you know, few weeks you have somebody on your team, or you come into a new team, you're going to be trying everything. And sometimes someone will say, oh no, we need a lot of technical drawing or mechanics, because we really want them to be very clean and tight, and our team does well with clear instructions on that, and you need to adapt to it. And it's all really just about being able to let go of the ego as well. I'll burn my art, I don't care at this point, but to get the best product, what do you need? And hopefully I can deliver that. So
hope we're not burning any art. Figuratively, whatever.
Figuratively, yeah. I haven't gotten to that frustration in my art yet. So
okay, good. So I have another question about, like, this maybe gets a little bit too much into the process, not too, like, and maybe strays a bit from the topic.
Process.
But when you're doing visual world building, I'm trying to tie it back in with the topic of the episode, right? So let's say you're working on a level. How many different pieces of art are you working with to help the team imagine that level? Like, how help them build it out? I'm sure there's not one answer, but the decision? Yeah.
Usually I'll put the ballpark into a lot. How about that? Because it is an iterative process. So, you know, you start off with getting the information of how big is this level and what am I going to be focusing on? Luckily, most of the time, at least recently, it's been, you know, arena levels. So I can have a distance of, you know, this is by X foot by X foot. And here's the theme. And, you know, I start off with really fast sketches, coming up with ideas of, like, all right, here's 6 or 7 concepts of what it could be. They're rough, they're messy, but at least they get the idea of what it will be later on. From there, once something's approved, it's a lot of, you know, prop sketching of what an actual piece will be, and then different variations on actual final design. So usually it's, you know, a quick 3D mock-up that you put into Photoshop, you paint over. Sometimes you'll do multiple color passes of different times of day or different lighting ideas. Different prop ideas are just put all over the place so you can sort of see how you populate it. And from there, it kind of comes into getting feedback from the team of like, oh no, this should be more orange, this should be lighter, I like the daytime scene. Mm-hmm. And if you have the time, you would refine it, get a, you know, a great design for ArtStation, but usually by the point that you're, you know, you get something up and it's finalized, you have to move on to something else. Yeah. And then you can do the ArtStation stuff off the clock.
Yeah.
So that final that final stage is probably emails. Right? Like rather than like additional drafts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's very much like you're done, you can send it off.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's, I mean, I often do maybe, I'm trying to think of in terms of like, I have like three documents usually for any one level, mm-hmm. but they've got, you know, 10, 15, 20 layers of pieces.
Yeah.
So it's really just how fast you can go through and come up with your answer. Mm-hmm. And if you're lucky, sometimes it's the first thing you draw, but oftentimes it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you structure a Photoshop document, how you've probably have refined this to a repeatable process, but because you need to work fast and iteratively when you go through those first drafts and that exploration, what are the things you need to be cognizant of so that that process can be less stressful for you? So it's not just like starting from a blank slate for version two, you know, like more layers than you normally work with, or avoiding excessive use of destructive filters, or like I'm looking for tips and tricks, really.
Okay, I'll be honest. Usually, it doesn't for me. Destructive filters are fine. Anything that is going to be adding on processing power, like high quality images, mm-hmm. don't need them. Anything if you have things like pile effects or things like that, oftentimes I'll just take a screenshot and then put it over instead of actually using the tiling effect, because it takes a lot of processing power. The one thing that every artist needs to do though is label your layers.
Hey.
And get a good naming convention.
If you learn nothing else from this episode.
If you learn nothing else, don't use final. Don't use like this is the final one. The best way I was ever taught was, you know, this and then V, what, like number, because then you can actually just cross back, save often, save multiple versions. And if you know how, save on GitHub, because you can do version control that way.
Yep.
Nice.
But yeah, honestly, just making sure you know what tools you like to use as well, because you need to do something fast. You just know, like, okay, I'm gonna use this pen and I'm just gonna draw it out, screenshot, send it in, because you don't need to be worrying about what the texture is gonna look like, what I'm gonna try out this new tool. It's like, don't do that on your own time, because like test things out on your own time and then come in with some more knowledge, because if you just continually try in new things, you're going to eat up a lot of your iterative process that you need to ideate. You need to get you need to actually draw something.
Is that frustrating?
Yeah, I suppose. Oh, well, go ahead.
Is that frustrating that like you just got, these are the skills I know, it's a big list, but if I try to add one, that's just going to slow me down? Did that ever get exhausting and to have to do that on your own time? Or do you try to carve out a little bit of space to give yourself some of that freedom? Or does it not bother you? Is it comforting to just have your toolbox and just be really good at it?
I mean, I have learned to carve out time on my own to try new things. Like even if it's not digital, you know, I've been learning more on gouache painting. I've been trying out a few different things with sculpting, because those skills can be used in my digital work. Maybe, you know, directly, but they are important. But it does take conscious effort to learn new skills, to, you know, figure out, okay, well, I'm going to test out these Photoshop brushes because I don't know what they're like. And then once you have, even if it's, you know, 15 minutes just to, you know, see how it works, use it in a really quick sketch painting. And then you know, like, oh, you know, next time I have to do a rock texture, I've got this brush. So you're not constantly guessing. You're trying to eke out as much time as you can so you have the breathing room to do what you want in your concepting on the job. Mm-hmm. Because it's a quick turnaround.
Yeah.
And if you have a good team, they will give you plenty of space. But even then, sometimes you just have to get something done on time.
Yeah.
Right.
But the only other thing I can think of is every artist needs to stretch and stretch often. And carpal tunnel is a bitch and will get us all if we do not stretch.
That goes for everyone. Stretching is important. I don't care if you're a programmer. I don't care if you're an artist.
Everybody's stretching right now.
Get up. Yep, you're stretching. Get up and stretch. That means you, listener. Get up and stretch.
That's our show. You can find Laura online on LinkedIn. For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and a case study on tutorial levels. Apply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and you get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
I feel like I'm going to need to give me like 5 minutes to think of something, but that's not fair.
We can cut out the thinking parts. We can cut out the thinking parts.